nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
All right, I guess we can start. I guess most of us were here yesterday at Orkin, so I don't have to repeat the long biography of Edward Gergoy from University of Pittsburgh. Edward, briefly, Edward is a particularly young-looking headlock and human rights activist. In the last couple of years, he worked on several problems in quantum information and quantum computing. That's what he will give today, a lack of quantum computing, which you promise to be accessible. Most of it will be actually answered by students, and perhaps in the end, get a few minutes to describe some more recent work he's actually working on. He worked on the entanglements between qubits, and he gave a generalized Schwarz algorithm in Oxford in 2004, and last week, a paper just came out on PRA on the dense coding quantum information transmission. So, please.
Yeah, right. Okay. Well, again, I'm really pleased to be here. I've been entertained royally, and I've just been fed a huge... If I fall asleep in the middle of the talk, you'll understand why. And I also have a sheet of sources available for this talk over there, if anybody's interested. And you said you were going to put copies of the other talks up, remember?
It won't be.
Now, let me make some introductory remarks. First of all, as I said yesterday, please don't hesitate to ask me questions during the talk, and I'll answer them if I have the time and so on. If not, I'll just go on. Now, this talk is an introduction to quantum computing, but the literature on quantum computing and the subject itself really binds quantum computing, which I'll call QC frequently, and quantum information, which I'll call QI. They're all tangled together. And in the more elaborate texts on this subject, you'll see an awful lot of QI. And the principal tome is a tome by Nielsen and Chuang. It's written 6 years ago. It's this thick. And that's all about quantum computing and quantum information. But you don't really need quantum information theory for what I'm going to be talking about today. I'm really giving an introduction to quantum computing, and therefore I'll discuss quantum computing and quantum information, but it's the big, big subject in itself. I'm hardly going to touch it, but I'll touch on it somewhat, but I just want you to understand that. And I will not have time, and there's some things Yang Chen asked me to describe some of my own work, what I've been doing. I don't think it's necessarily that important, but I don't have time. I really am pressed for time in this talk, and what I'm saying now probably I shouldn't say, but I won't have time to really cover it, because I really hate to give a talk and sit in an audience and the talk goes on and on, so I don't want to subject you to that. I'm going to try to stay within the hour I'm supposed to talk. But those of you who are interested, I think I will be happy to stay behind afterward. And if you want to get some more details on some of the things I've been doing, I'll be glad to talk about it. So that's what I intend to do. But this part of the talk is just an introduction to quantum computing. Okay? All right. Now, I will start out by saying that I suppose I should try to answer the question, what is a quantum computer? Because when I started to learn about quantum computing, I wanted to know, what is a quantum computer? Well, if you look in the literature, it's surprising how unuseful the answers you get. For instance, here is a typical answer, the definition. It's taken from a 1999 National Science Foundation workshop. And here's, I'm just reading, I'm quoting. While today's digital computers process classical information encoded in bits, a quantum computer processes information encoded in quantum bits or qubits. Well, I don't know about you, but I did not find that a very useful definition. So, and then you'll notice again, quantum information is linked with quantum computing. So let me try to clarify several things here. And the first thing I think I want to clarify is, what do you mean by a quantum bit? Now, I think all of you in this audience, I don't have to try to amplify as what's meant by a bit. I mean, in classical computing and so on, a bit is an item of information. It's a physical system which can be visualized in one of either two states. Either it's a switch, either it's on or it's off. Classical computers are comprised of millions, maybe more than millions, billions of bits, and they're either up or down in effect. And classically, what we do is we say the zero represents up, if you want to think of it that way, and one gets down. And customarily, I'm compressed for space here, but I'll take this little piece here. Dirac notation is customary, so there's a zero state and the one state, and that's all you're entitled to. Okay, no, that's all. So anyway, I will refer to this equation. I will refer to this equation a couple of times, but anyway, in quantum bits, this represents what corresponds to the up state of the switch, and this corresponds to the down. And alpha and beta are complex numbers. Alpha squared plus beta squared equals 1, because it's normalized. This wave function is normalized, and this is the wave function for a single bit. I mean, that's all I have to say here about that. Okay, now, physical classical systems, like switches and so on, they're classical. They have zillions of atoms in them, and they can get even smaller, and they still have zillions of atoms. But a point is reached where the system gets so small that it's no longer describable classically, and you have to start describing the system quantum mechanically and using the Schrödinger equation. And that's essentially where you are when you start to talk about a quantum bit. But the essential feature of a quantum bit is that it's still true that it only has essentially two states. If I try to observe it, it's either in one of two states, and that's all. It's a system which is a Hilbert space, is a two-dimensional Hilbert space, and that's all it is. And the typical visualization, if you, is a an electron, let's say, and a Stern-Gerlach experiment, where if you send the electron beam through, either it goes this way or it goes that way in the magnetic field. But of course, you know, I can orient the magnetic field. I can have the magnetic field pointing this way, and then it'll go either this way or that way. All you're going to get are two possible states, but the wave function, which represents, let's say, pointing up for a magnetic field with a gradient along z, is very different from the wave function, which represents up for a wave function with a gradient along x. But with that understanding, I can represent my wave function along x in terms of the wave function along z. It's a two-dimensional system, and that's what I'm talking about. That's what a quantum bit is then. It's a system for which you make a measurement, you decide on what, and you have to decide on the basis. And it's customary, by the way, in quantum computing language to talk about the representational basis, but I mean, I don't need to do the computational basis, I mean. But I'll just say, I mean, you have to distinguish. I want to make it clear, I'm talking about the z direction, or I'm talking about the x direction. That basis has to be specified. All right. Now, having said that, I think of you now know, I hope, what a quantum bit is supposed to be like, and I will take a minute to tell you, yes?
Is it only for convenience you think of two states? What prevents us to think in more than one?
No. They're a Now, let me say, it's called a qubit because it's just a binary system. People talk about qutrits, which represents, I mean, a spin a half system has only two states, and that's the analog you think of a qubit. I can think of a spin one system, which is a qutrit. I can speak of a system of arbitrary dimensions, which the quantum physicists call qdit, the quantum computer guys, qdit. I am talking about qubits because at the present time, the analogy with classical computers is clear, because classical computers really are only up or down. They're the bits. And secondly, it turns out that making qubits is hard enough, so making qutrits is going to be that much harder. And as of now, there's been no serious consideration of trying to make computers which involve more complicated systems. But you could. The other advantage of qubits is that we're used to thinking of the binary code. We use ordinary computers, classical computers, and we naturally write numbers in the binary system because the bits in the quantum computer are 0, 1. And similarly here, so if I talk about qubits, I can then think of the state of the system in terms of a binary number. But there's nothing in principle prevents me from using a spin of arbitrary dimensions. Okay, all right, fine. So, I think the next thing I want to do is give you some illustration, and I'll turn this on. Here are possible, and I want to spend some time on this, as I say, because it's too easy to speak abstractly of qubits. So, here are possible realizations of qubits, and as you can see, I have trapped ions, potential wells, I have neutral atoms. I mean, I can go on. You can look at the whole thing. And these headings here are essentially taken from chapter headings in a U.S. Army 2004 so-called quantum computing roadmap. It's a very thorough discussion of all possible routes to constructing a working quantum computer. And all these things are being talked about. This last part is a chapter of exotic qubits, and I've listed these anions because I understand you had a talk here not so long ago on topological quantum computing in which anions are featured. But I don't know of myself of any serious attempt right now to really make a quantum computer use the anions, all the people are working at it. And there's a lot of money being spent on this. What the slide is not, I am going to talk in a minute about item one, which is trapped ions, because that seems to be further along than most, perhaps the farthest along. But all these are being worked on, and I'm not going to try to predict which will actually turn out to be the best, but I will try to indicate to you some of the complications that you have, say, building a computer with trapped ions. Now, one thing I don't have on the slide is NMR, nuclear magnetic resonance. Nuclear magnetic resonance quantum computing has been discussed, and as a matter of fact, to my knowledge, the largest collection of qubits which have been used to make a calculation, in fact, maybe the only collection, has been via NMR, which was used to factor 15. The number 15 was factored using Shor's algorithm, about which I'll talk later, was factored by NMR. And what you had were molecules. In NMR, you know, what you do is have a vast collection of molecules, and you put radiation into them, you get reflected radiation back and so on, and by analyzing this radiation, you decide what's going on. And the reason I don't think it's a path is, as I will explain, if you really want to have a quantum computer which will solve problems of practical interest, you need thousands and maybe millions of qubits. And what happens in NMR is that each molecule, each nucleus on that molecule is a qubit. That's what it acts like. And I just don't believe we'll ever be able to make this work with nuclear magnetic resonance, that vast number of qubits. And so I'm not taking that route. And as a matter of fact, that route was not seriously taken, not looked at, although some, in that roadmap that I discussed. Okay, so here's we are. And now, for any of those realizations of qubits to be useful, I wrote that equation on the board. What you have to do, the following. You have to, at a minimum, measure the state of the qubit. Now, you realize you're going to have a vast collection of qubits, but I'm now at the moment talking about any one of them. I'm interested in that particular qubit for whatever reason. I have to be able to measure its state, and decide what its wave function state is. And that's the whole point. And I also have to be able to set up my computer and put the qubit in any arbitrary state that I want. Otherwise, of what use is it again? So that's my problem. I've got to design these qubits so that I can measure them and that I can set them up the way I want to. Okay. So now, that said, let me go on to the next slide. This is a slide taken from a talk by David Wineland, who's an experimentalist at Boulder, who's working, and he is using trapped ion qubits. And a trapped ion, the ions are trapped in, they're localized to within about 10 to 20 microns. But, I mean, I could show you a slide I have somewhere, and they're a little potential well, but you understand it's not a potential well in all directions, because Earnshaw's theorem, which I hope the graduate students here learned, you cannot, because of Laplace's equation is such d squared v, dx squared v, dy, so on, equals zero. You can't get minima of all these potentials in all directions. So actually, you have to use a combination of radiation plus electric fields to trap these ions, and that's what you do. And then, so what happens in beryllium 9 is the following. The beryllium 9 qubit, beryllium 9 has a nuclear spin of a half. I'm sorry, three halves. And the state of the electron is double it s a half. So the possible states of the system, F equals J plus I, are either F equals 2, total angular momentum, or F equals 1. And the states which are used by Wineland and by other people, beryllium is one of the favorite ions, is the F equals 2, MF equals minus 2, and the F equals 1, yeah, thanks, MF equals minus 1 states. Those are the two, and he uses down and up for what other people would use, 0 and 1. That's just his notation. So that's my 0 and 1 he's using down and up there. And now transitions between these qubits are obtained by use of a pair of lasers, and what you do is you essentially you go up here and you come down here, and the resonance is between the difference frequency between this pair of lasers is some chosen useful intermediate state, and that's how you tune these lasers back and forth, and by the phase differences between them, which you control by the length of the pulse and so on, you adjust these factors, theta and phi, and that'll give you the arbitrary alpha and beta that I discussed. And now this is just for one qubit. If you want to just get a pair of qubits, and again, I will emphasize, and I'll explain later, I hope, why, I also have to control pairs of qubits. I cannot make this computer just using operations on a single qubit. But I need pairs. And the pairs have to be anywhere. In other words, have this vast array of qubits, maybe thousands, maybe millions. I have to be able to get any given pair of qubits and get the combined wave function in the state that I want. And in order to do this, I have to maybe manipulate and I have to use lasers like this and so on, whatever I'd have to do. And all this equipment, I say, I don't know how many lasers you're going to need. If each laser could only work on one qubit, you would need two times the number of qubits. Well, presumably, you're going to figure out some system whereby one laser will do this qubit and then that qubit and so on. But for instance, you have to build this thing. You have to be sure that every qubit is really tuned the same way. I mean, they live in different environments. Out here at the end of the system, there may be somewhat different electromagnetic fields around than they are there. But you have to somehow control this and be able to do this, otherwise you can't control it. That's what I emphasize. These are the problems in actually making it happen. To my knowledge, at the present time, there have been something like arrays, linear arrays of 7 or 8 trapped ions in which people have been able to work and so on. Not much more than that that I know of. Okay. So, all right, with that, let me go on. Now, I've talked about one qubit then. Let me start talking about two qubits. And the magic word there is entanglement. It's a general belief and understanding that if you want to build a computer, you're going to have to take advantage of quantum entanglement. Now, what do I mean by entanglement? This slide tries to explain it, and I will also take advantage, before I talk about that slide, I will read to you again a typical statement which you find in the literature. And this is from Nielsen Chuang. Entanglement is the feature of the quantum world that distinguishes it from the classical world, saying for a single pair of systems, a description of each system's state is not sufficient to describe the entire state of the system. It's the feature of quantum systems that makes exponential speed-up of computation possible. Okay, so what do I mean by entanglement? And, you know, it's so interesting. Although entanglement was first used by Schrödinger, back not long after he published the Schrödinger equation, I never heard the word, when I was studying, I never heard the word entanglement. It was never used.
I said in the old books, for example, there is a book by Schiff, which in my days was the gospel of the
mechanics. That's right. Well, Schiff learned his quantum mechanics while working with Oppenheimer. He was Oppenheimer's research associate. And then he went over and he wrote, yes, there's not a word about entanglement. Absolutely right. Well, anyway, what do I mean by entanglement? I've written down here the most general two-qubit equation. I mean, I've picked some basis, and then, you know, so that's, this is now two qubits, so the Hilbert space is four-dimensional, and so that means any wave function can be written as a linear combination of four independent wave functions. I've taken the states, A is one qubit, B is the other qubit, so this is this, so the states are 0, 0 for A and B, 0, 1 for A, B, 1, 0, 1A, 0B, 1, 1, 1A, 1B, and there are four coefficients, and the sum of the coefficients squared is 1, because the wave function is normalized, and that is the most general thing. Okay, now, if psi is a simple product of a function of A only and a function of B only, then it's unentangled. Otherwise, it is entangled. That is the definition. So, illustration. This is unentangled, 0A, 1B. This is unentangled. 1 over the square root of 3, 0A, plus 2/3, 1A, times 1/2, 0B, minus I, and so on, B. That's unentangled. It's a product. On the other hand, here's entangled. 0A, 1B, plus 1A, 0B. You can't write that as a simple product. Here's another one that's entangled. Now, if I write down the general case, it's actually frequently very hard to tell, just looking at it, whether it's entangled or unentangled. As it happens, this one is, and I think it's that one. I'll tell you which one. I've forgotten myself. yes, the first one is unentangled. This one is unentangled, and this one is entangled, and all I did was change the sign of this first term. They're simple criteria, but anyway, that's the story. And if this is for two qubits, if I'm talking about many, many, many qubits, the criterion is the same. If this many-qubit function can be written as a simple product of UA, that's one qubit, second qubit B, and the third qubit C, and so on, it's unentangled. If it cannot be written that way, it's entangled in at least one pair of the qubits, and so on. That's the story. Okay. That's all I need to say on that. Now, what I want to say is that I want you to recognize is that the implications of entanglement are quite surprising and not always expected. Let me explain now what that means. Time is flying.
Yes? You talk about entanglement. Can you also build up algebra like the prime number
Say that again. Which mem?
When we have so many cubics, you have a state which cannot be factored by any pair of products.
Yes.
So you can do that sort of like a mem.
You can, yes. I'm not sure. There's all kinds of algebras and so on in this, which I'm not acquainted. Yes, the answer is yes, obviously. But at the moment, I don't know that, and I'm not. There have been various algebrae, but I don't know of this particular application. But there are what there are. There's a huge literature on measuring the degree of entanglement, and that's a different question, which I may be able to have time to talk about. And there you have full entanglement, and the question is, in general, let me just say for your information, if these coefficients are all equal, if in this case it's normalized, if each of these coefficients are 1/2, that's the maximally entangled state. And if any of them differ from one, I mean, they start to differ, that's less and less entangled. And then you go down to the place where one of them is 1, all the others are 0, and that's a full non-entanglement. So that's the sort of thing. And the thing is measured by a concept called the Von-Neumann entropy, which is a generalization of a classical information, Shannon entropy, which is used in classical information theory. And it's only one of the measures. It's not necessarily the one that works that best. Okay, now, what I wanted to say was this. Take a look at this expression here. This is unentangled. If I decide to measure qubit A, I don't know. I'm doing a measurement of qubit A. I don't know whether I'm going to end up with a 0 state or the 1 state. That's quantum mechanics. I have a probability here, 1/3 of getting 0 and 2/3 of getting 1. Whichever state I get in the end does not affect the probabilities of making a further measurement on B. So whether I get 1 the first time or 0 the first time, my probabilities of getting 0 when I measure B is still 1/4, and the probability of getting 1 when I measure B is still 3/4. See, that's not been affected. However, when they're entangled, here's a typical entangled state. The probability of getting 0 when I measure, if I talk about qubit A, the probability of getting 0 is 1/2, and the probability of getting 1 is 1/2. But if I measure 0, if I measure it and I happen to get 0, if I try to measure B after that, I have 100% probability of getting 1. I have no chance of getting 0. If I happen to get 1 when I measure A, my probability of getting 0 afterward is 100%, and the probability of getting 1 is 0%. And so when a system is entangled, the measurement on 1 affects the probabilities of getting the second. Now, this has been, this does not depend upon the qubits being, there's no interaction between the qubits that does this. They don't have to be next to each other. They can be separated. They can be in separate counties. They can be in separate universes. The point is, this is a property of entanglement. Now, I haven't written down the complete wave function. Obviously, you say, how can they be in separate counties? Well, the point is, what I've written down here is just the qubit part, the spin part, if you like. These wave functions are multiplied by spatial dependencies, and so this wave function can be a wave packet in which qubit A has a wave packet centered over there, and qubit B has a wave packet centered over there. So the total wave function gives you zero probability, essentially, of measuring qubit A anywhere but here, and zero probability so that, but there's no interaction between them that I've said. This is all independent. Now, this fact has given rise to all this discussion about quantum mechanics being non-local. And this is also inherent in the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen discussion, which I don't want to get into here, and which physicists do know about now and talk about. But I do want to say, which is maybe not recognized widely, this fact, which I've just indicated, also makes possible communication of messages, sending messages, essentially instantaneously, faster than the velocity of light. Now, none of us believe this, that you can do that, but nevertheless, this is what, and the reason you cannot send messages faster than the velocity of light, superluminal messaging, is that somewhere in the process of actually making a message work, you have to copy a wave function. And what you can prove is a so-called no-cloning theorem, is that you cannot clone wave functions. If I want to state the theorem accurately, you cannot find an operator. You cannot, for an unknown wave function, you cannot find an operator which will clone for you a pair of different wave functions. You don't know which one you're trying to clone if they're not orthogonal to each other. That is the accurate statement of the no-cloning theorem. Now, the no-cloning theorem is another thing which I don't recall ever seeing mentioned when I learned quantum mechanics. And it's not known. I don't know how many of you in this audience, how many of you are graduate students here? Have you talked about the no-cloning theorem? Have you? Yes or no? I can't hear.
No.
Yeah. See, it's just not. Now, what's interesting, and I, if there's time, and I really want to, but I just don't know if I have the time now. But if I have the time, I'll be glad to stay around and show you first how the argument goes that you would be able to transmit messages, and then secondly, why the no-cloning theorem is necessary, and then show you the proof of the no-cloning theorem, which is amazingly simple, and the real thing that's interesting about this is how long it took for this to develop. The no-cloning theorem was first proved in 1982. Now, you can do it in four lines. I mean, it's just nothing. And it was only proved in 1982 by Wouters and Zurich because in the same year appeared the first paper which recognized that you could send instantaneous messages as a result of entanglement. And then Wouters and Zurich proved, no, that wasn't true because you couldn't clone. That was a necessary step. And as they say, and this again is not discussed, it's just surprising. It was surprising to me. All right, so now, this is all quantum information, really, and I'm going to go away from this. So from now on, I'm not talking about quantum information anymore, but I'm going to get back to the question I started with, what is a quantum computer? And so I say, you all understand what the quantum computer is. It's this collection, the operator. By the way, I'm going to speak of the operator of the computer, but when I speak from now on, I'll say the controller. And I'm going to say controller because I don't want to confuse you between the guy who runs the computer and actual operators in quantum mechanics of the world, because I'm going to talk about unitary and so on. So the quantum controller, the controller does this. What can he do? We generally agreed that the only operations he can make are unitary operations. And so let me show you the next slide. Here are the permitted quantum computer operations. And you see, the computer, each qubit and the computer, the whole, a collection of qubits, obeys some super Schrodinger equation. And as it evolves in time, you're going from one state to the next and so on. If the Hamiltonian is time independent, that first equation there is what governs it. And if the Hamiltonian is time dependent, time ordered, it's this time ordering operator. But both of them are unitary, whether it's U1 or U2, they obey U adjoint equals U adjoint U equals the identity operator in the space, so they're unitary. And now I will give you my definition of quantum computation, which I hope will be useful. And I'll read it because it's important. Any particular quantum computation involves finding a sequence of unitary operations that will transform some chosen initial computer wave function into a final wave function wherein there's a non-negligible probability of measuring those combinations of qubit states that can be interpreted as yielding the outcome of the computation. That's my definition of a quantum computer. And the reason this is important, we're in quantum mechanics. Suppose I have a computer which has 1,000 qubits in it. If I just have an arbitrary state and I want to make a measurement on it, the probability of getting any particular state I want is 1 over 2 to the nth, 1 over 2 to the thousandths. I mean, that's not going to do me any good at all, obviously. So I've got to somehow transform that wave function into something so at the end when I make a measurement, there's at least a chance that out of that measurement I can infer what is the desired result of the calculation. And I'll be talking about this in Shor's algorithm. And the point I want to make, and I'll make it again, well, if the quantum computer is working the way you want, it's this great a device and it works so fast and so on, that's just quantum mechanics. So, I mean, suppose the probability of getting your answer is 1%, you know, it's a huge computer, but you've worked with the wave function and you've got it so it's a 1% chance of getting the answer you want. Well, 99% of the time you won't. Well, that's okay. This computer is so great, I'll just do it again. And I'll do it again. I mean, it doesn't matter if I have to do it 500 times. And the whole trick now, the key to this is, you have to have a fast way of checking whether the answer you've gotten is the answer you want. If you have to go through it, so, for instance, factoring. Shor's algorithm is a factoring algorithm. Well, factoring is very difficult, I'll try to explain. But it's very easy to check. If I give you a pair of numbers and I say they're the factors of this large number, I just multiply them together, I can see whether the factors are not. So the key problems you're dealing with are problems in which, once you get this answer, you know very rapidly whether it's the right one or not, and where you can afford, if it isn't the right one, you can just do the calculation again and again until you get the right answer. So that's what quantum computers are going to be like. Are there any questions about that?
It requires implementation.
I didn't hear you.
The essential thing is that if you really want to compute, you should be able to represent, for instance, as in the binary system, the computers, A is put as 0011 something. So characterization and representation. Here we have to capture. So a particular state you are able to be certain that it is a state. I'm able to see it as up or down or 0 or 1 as you are saying.
For each of the qubits, yeah. But usually, let's say, I'll show you in Shor's algorithm, usually the measurement you make will not be the answer you want. In other words, you're usually not doing this kind of problem where you say, I take two numbers and I multiply them together, and I've sort of gotten the final state of the computer to be one state, and I know what to measure so that I can only get that state. I mean, to get that state would sort of mean that the computer would have to be written as 1111 or 000, just one number. The final wave function would not be entangled, because if the final wave function is entangled, I definitely cannot be sure what answer I'm going to get.
Now, what I'm asking, sir, if you take two numbers in the binary system, any number, I represent in the form of binary.
Absolutely.
So similarly here, you should be able to arrive at that position where you are sure that this number, which in my binary system, is this number. That representation is essential. You should be able to capture it first.
Yes.
Then only question of multiplying two numbers will come and looking at it, right?
Yeah, but I want to emphasize, you see, what you're saying essentially is that my wave function is going to be unentangled. In other words, let's take the number 4, just to do it, it's 3, okay. 3 in the binary system will be written as 1-1. So the two-qubit system, qubit A will be in the one state and qubit B will be in the two state. The state is 1-1. Take any of these numbers you want, it's going to be a single number. If the wave function is entangled, one of the parts may be 1-1, the other part may be 0-0. If I get 0-0, that's not the answer I want. Now, typically in working with a quantum computer, you have to start out with an entangled state, and you're going to end up with an entangled state. So that you don't have the luxury, very rarely will it be, you do make measurements, I want to stress. I don't want to say it's impossible, because you make measurements at various stages, and it might be you'll end up with an unentangled state of the one you want, but that's certainly not what typically happens. It doesn't happen in Shor's algorithm, which I'm going to talk about. You do not end up with a simple number.
So to my mind, it appears to be able to distinguish when an entanglement takes place, when it does not take place. Characterization of that seems to be the fundamental.
Yes, and you can. As they say, there are tests, there are various criteria for what's entanglement and so on. But whether you want to go through that, because you have to make measurements, and you want to recognize when you make a measurement on the computer wave function, you've destroyed it. This is quantum mechanics. The information is there until I make a measurement, and then the reduction of the wave function takes place, and there's another wave function. I've lost that information. So you have to,
Sorry, I don't want to go.
Yeah, okay. But that's all right. I mean, if, yeah. All right, let me continue.
If I understood it correctly, but after their statement, you can actually use quantum. You can actually simulate a classic computer with quantum computer. That's not the way you want to use quantum computer, but any classic operation you can perform.
You want,
but let me now show you. Yeah. Yes. Let me, if I may, let me show you a model of quantum computation. This is the circuit model of quantum computation, which is the most common model. And in the circuit model, you visualize each qubit as following a timeline from left to right. You go from here to there. I start here, and I go there. And then somewhere along the line, I do a measurement, and then that measurement gives me the information I want. And now in this computer, what I've done here, it's typical. Typically, you set them all up in the zero state, and they have registers in these computers. I have two registers in the Shor's algorithm. So I've written here two registers. First register is qubits A, B, and C. Second register is qubits D and E, and I perform a so-called Hadamard operation. That's the first thing I do on each of these first three qubits. I can do them simultaneously because they're not interlocked. And I've shown over here, this is the one-dimensional unitary, it's 2x2, one qubit unitary operator, which forms a Hadamard. And what it does is takes zero into a linear combination of zero and one with equal probability. So when I get through with this, here's the state I started with. It's 0, 0, 0, written like this. When I get through, it's this state. And if you look at it, if you write it out in binary symbols, it's actually the numbers from 0 to 7, all in binary systems. So the Hadamard enables you, and frequently, very many calculations in quantum computer, they're designed, you start out by putting in there, into the system, all the numbers that the system can hold in equal probability, and then you start operating on them. For instance, I can raise it to a power, I can do various things like that. Now, the next thing I've done in this is that I've decided to use a CNOT operation, so-called. That's a binary operation between qubits B and D. And I've written over here what the CNOT operator looks like. That's a 4x4 matrix because it involves two qubits. Now, when I get through with that, that entangles them. That matrix now looks like, if I write it out, it's this one and then plus this one, and they're all still operating times 0e because I haven't touched that, but it's entangled A, B, C, and D. And that's what and then you go on for like that. And then over here, for instance, I've shown, here's a 3-qubit operation, which I haven't tried to detail. And then I make a measurement. And if I've done this right, if I'm calculated right, if my algorithm, that's what an algorithm is for, I've gotten a high probability, whatever state I find here, it's a high probability I will be able to find a state of giving me the answer I want. Okay. Now, let me elaborate that because I know you don't believe me, but you now know how to do it. Well, you now know what quantum computation is like. I've really told you all you need to know. Now, there are a few things I have to add. One of the things is this. I've shown here a 3x3 operator. Well, you can do that. But now, suppose I have 10 qubits, I have a typical algorithm. In the course of the algorithm, I'm going to want to entangle and operate and so on some complicated way in all 10 qubits. That's a matrix. Remember, each qubit has two states. So to operate on a 10-qubit system in general is a unitary operator whose dimensions are 1 over 2 to the 10th, that's 1028 by 1028. That's a pretty complicated matrix. And if you try to find a system, a set of operations where I'm going to do with lasers and so on and do this, you'll never do it. So there's a very, very important theorem which is proved, and that is that any unitary operator which is greater than 4x4, in other words, any unitary operator which corresponds to operations on more than 2 qubits, can be reduced to a succession of 2-qubit and 1-qubit operations. And that's the only thing that makes it possible to make them, because otherwise it would be ridiculous. So the algorithm consists not only of figuring out what operation you want to do, but also in constructing the sequence, and these operations are called gates. There are 1-qubit gates and 2-qubit gates, of constructing the sequence of 1-qubit and 2-qubit gates that will produce the operation final result you want. And also, there's some theorems that not all 4x4 matrices are needed. There are so-called universal gates, 2-qubit gates, of which the C-naught is one of them. So, for instance, I can quote you the theorem that actually any more than 2x2 unitary operator can be reduced to a product, and of course, of 1-qubit gates plus C-naught gates, taken in the proper order. So, and that's also, therefore, what that means is that if I'm building a quantum computer, now the C-naught may not be the most easy to produce, whatever it is, but I will not have to learn how to make a lot of gates. I can only make a few 2-qubit gates, and that way I can build the quantum computer that way. Okay, are we with it? Yeah, all right. We still have a lot to go. So, let me now show you, what is Shor's algorithm? Because Shor's algorithm is at the present, as of now, the most successful example of what a quantum computer can do. There are very few such examples, as I hope I'll have time to elaborate on. So here is what is Shor's algorithm. You take a large prime, which is a product, a large number, which is a product of two primes, being to a different odd primes. Then Shor's algorithm enables a quantum computer to find the prime factors P and Q of N. And for large N, the whole point is the quantum computer, using Shor's algorithm, will factor N with less computational effort than a classical computer. But I have to carefully define what I mean by less computational effort. Now, the paper which first did this was by Shor. He did this a couple of years before this. He wrote a completely unintelligible paper. Then a couple of these years later, he wrote another paper, which is slightly more intelligible, not much. I have written one of the... I've got interest... Anyway, I have written, which it's listed in the... This there. I've written a... intelligible, or at least hopefully intelligible, discussion of Shor's algorithm in the American Journal of Physics a couple of years ago. It's a long paper, but it goes through all the underlying mathematics, which is number theory, and explains how it works, and explains its importance. And I have been told by people, and I'll pass it along without modesty, that it's really a great paper on Shor's algorithm. So I recommend it to you. I do not have too much time to talk about Shor's algorithm. I'll talk a little bit. But if you really want to understand what's going on it, you have to look at that paper. Now, I do want to show you the following slide, however. See, in Shor's algorithm, actually, you start out in Shor's algorithm by... You have the registers, and for reasons I'll explain later, but you need about a register. The first register contains a couple of thousand qubits at least, and then the other register equally. So you start out with 4,000 or 5,000 qubits, and you may need more, which I'll also try to explain. But now, in these, and then you go through your operations. You end up, as I say, you measure at the end the first register. The second register is measured earlier. You know, it's the first register. So you have 1/2 to 2,000 or so is your chance of getting the right state. You've got to operate on that wave function so you can get something out of it. Now, this is a simulation in which the first register is composed of 8 qubits. So it can represent 256 different binary numbers. You start out at the beginning with a Hadamard system in which all these numbers are of equal probability. Then you use Shor's algorithm. And what happens is that here are the probabilities. There are only certain numbers which you get with high probability, and these are smaller. And the whole point of Shor's algorithm is there's a period, in this case the period is 26, and that's a number which comes out of the number theory. Shor's algorithm involves, the key step in the algorithm involves a quantum Fourier transform. And that picks out a period. And it turns out if you know that period, you can factor the numbers. That's the whole point. Now, none of these P peaks here guarantee that you can factor the number, but they give you a fair probability of being able to factor the number. So instead of getting all possible numbers, when you make a measurement of the state, you're going to get this one, or this one, or this one, or this one. And from each of those numbers, you have a good chance of getting the period and factoring it. And as I said, it's not guaranteed. But if it doesn't work, well, you just try again, because I'll explain in a minute. You're so much better off than you were with a classical computer, you can afford to waste a lot of time like this. Somebody have a question? Okay.
What does it really mean to say it works, it doesn't work?
Well, I didn't hear you.
What does it really mean to say that if it doesn't work, you try again?
I mean, you start over. You set up the computer in its initial register, and you go through the whole process. But as I'll explain, what you do in Shor's algorithm, you pick a number arbitrarily at the beginning, and you go through you take one of those numbers and you raise the numbers to powers in the first register, and you go through a whole process. And if it doesn't work, you start again, you pick another number at random, and you go through this process again, make the measurement, and you go through it again. And when you end up with a number which you think are the factors, you try them. If it doesn't work, which you have a classical computer, that's what I mean by doing it again. Okay, so let me explain now what I'm talking about when I say that Shor's algorithm is useful. First of all, let me give you an idea of what factoring is like classically. Now, how would you factor a number, a big, big number? The numbers I'm talking about, they're numbers of the order of 10 to the 309 at the present times, the numbers being used in coding and modern coding systems for security. That's a number of over 300 decimal digits. We're talking about factoring numbers of that size. Now, how would you go about doing this? I mean, this describes the crudest attempt. The numbers P and Q have to be, I mean, one of them has to be less than or equal to the square root of N. So I've talked here about, let's say the number I want to factor is 10 to the 100th. Never mind 10 to the 300th, 10 to the 100th. So I can divide by all the numbers, integers, from 2, 3, 4, and up to the square root of N, 10 to the 50th. And eventually I'll hit a factor. I've got to. Okay. Well, how long will that take? Suppose the average time to perform a division is 10 to the minus 12 seconds. And that's pretty small. The total time to find the factor will be 10 to the minus 12 times 10 to the 50th. That's 10 to the 38th. The age of the universe is only 10 to the 17 seconds. So you know that's not going to work. Well, how do mathematicians do it? Mathematicians have developed schemes, and the present scheme is something called the number field sieve. If you read books on number theory and so on, the number field sieve is a modern method for factoring. But it's still a long and arduous method. There is a corporation called the RSA Corporation, which is started by three professors at MIT who developed a modern system of coding, and they set up a factoring challenge. If you go to the website, they set up a factoring because they want to see. Anyway, the largest number which has been factored so far is roughly 10 to the 200th, and that took 55 years on a fast CPU computer. So 10 to the 300th is just out of sight. Now, I have to explain the following. I'm over time. How much more time can I have?
Can I have 5 minutes?
All right, let me just try to wind. I knew I would not be able to do the other. Yeah. See, what? I'm comparing apples and oranges here. I mean, I'm talking about classical computers and quantum computers. Who knows how long it will take for this computer controller to really set up an operation. So what do I mean by saying that the quantum computer is faster? The key idea here is what's called complexity, and it's an idea developed in computer science. The complexity is a number which tells you, it's a measure of how fast the number of operations needed in the problem grow as a function of the size of this system. So, for instance, if I'm factoring, I mean, using a classical computer, a fair estimate of the complexity is the number of elementary bit operations I have to do on the classical computer to get my answer. And it turns out this number, using the number field, numbers field sieve, that operation grows exponentially with n, the number to be factored. So, as I'm fond of saying, suppose I developed a fantastically fast computer, and I developed a computer which could factor this number n of 10 to the 300 in 2 weeks. All that the RSA Corporation has to do is decide to make their code depend upon numbers n of the 10 to the 600, the square of the previous n. You'll believe me, it's a fact, that I can find primes much more easily than I can factor. I can, there's a marvelous paper which wrote, in which somebody sells primes. He has a business selling primes. It's just nothing to it. But factoring is much harder. So all that the RSA Corporation I do is find primes of the order of n instead of the square root of n. If this same computer, which was able to factor the number 10 to the 300 in 2 weeks, would then take something like 60 million years to factor the number of the order of 10 to the 600. That's what the complexity does. Now, what happens with a quantum computer? Using Shor's algorithm, the complexity of the Shor's algorithm is something, it's a number between, whose power is between 2 and 3. It's a radical. But anyway, if on the Shor's algorithm, you had a quantum computer which was able to factor this number in 2 weeks, and the RSA system, then developed this new number, it would take the factoring with using the same quantum computer only 11 weeks. And it's in this sense that the quantum computer is so much more powerful than the classical computer. The complexity of this particular algorithm using the quantum computer is so enormously better. And now you understand what I mean when I say that if it took you a little more time, you had to do it again and again, you would not care. But it all depends upon the assumption that the quantum computer operations will be sufficiently rapid control. But what I can tell you, guarantee, because of this complexity, is that if the numbers are made big enough, eventually the quantum computer has to beat out the classical computer in time, because the complexity is going only as a power, a simple power, and the other one is going exponentially. Have I made that clear? I'll tell you, I've probably said all I can say reasonably. I want to say just a few more things now about quantum computers, if I may. Yeah, I still have a few minutes. Now, what I've told you about quantum computers, I mean, everything has been completely correct, but I haven't told you anything about some of the modern developments. I mean, I've only described this circuit model. Now, there have been in recent years, and this is actually relatively recent, just a few years, a couple of other models of quantum computation. One of the so-called circuit model, or the measurement model, not the circuit, I mean the measurement model, or the cluster model, or sometimes called graph state. Anyway, the idea there is this. You start out with a system which is all, I mean, it's a linear array. You visualize a linear array of qubits all tangled together by operators which are like C-knots, not quite. And then once you've got them in that array, the process of the algorithm consists, I make a measurement on, say, the first computer. I know what I'm doing, but I make a measurement here. I don't know whether the computer's going to give me a 0 or 1. Remember, it's a qubit. I make a measurement for it. Well, depending upon whether I get a 0 or 1, I perform an operation. I have a rule for that. I perform a 1-qubit operation on the next unitary operation, then I make another measurement. And then again, depending on the result I get, I make a measurement in the third qubit. And it can be shown that that process, if carried out, will result in the same final result as you can by the typical algorithm, whatever algorithm you have in the circuit model. Now, what is the advantage of this? The advantage of this is that you're only doing 1-qubit operations. You never have to do a 2-qubit operation. And 2-qubit operations are much harder, as they say, especially if they're qubits in far ends of the computer. That's the great advantage. The great disadvantage is, how do you get this first state that you wanted in the first place? But the theory is, the hope is, the idea is, that you'll somehow get smart enough and invent the Hamiltonian such that the ground state of this Hamiltonian is the state you want to start with, which is all entangled in the right way. And if you could do that, then after that, you know, you would then just grind out the calculations I've indicated. And that's the cluster model. I don't know what anybody, but I'm just, and a lot of research on this, and it's very popular. Another possible model is the adiabatic quantum computing. Adiabatic quantum computing is sort of rare. Again, I start with a ground state. In this case, I start with a simple ground state I showed there, let's say, just with all the qubits in the zero state, whatever it is. And then the idea is, I adiabatically modify the Hamiltonian. That means very slowly. And I adiabatically transform the Hamiltonian. I transform it. If I do it adiabatically, I never make a jump from the qubits, from the computer state to another unwanted state. And I eventually transform the Hamiltonian to a Hamiltonian, which the ground state is a Hamiltonian I would have gotten as a result of my previous algorithm. So that's adiabatic computing. And the question there, of course, is whether you can ever do that with an infinite time, considering that they're used to such complicated systems and the energy levels are so close together. And those of you who learned elementary quantum mechanics, you know that in order to avoid transitions between different states, you've got to be sure that these states are separated. Whatever they're separated by, you've got to move exponentially through that crossing very, very slowly, or otherwise you're going to jump to the wrong state. So that's adiabatic quantum. And then you learned about topological quantum computing the other day. And the only other thing I wanted to say, really, is that there is a surprising amount of nonsense. Or what I shouldn't call it nonsense, but a surprising amount of number of papers which I consider very strange. And so let me tell you, this is my final word, there is something which is called counterfactual quantum computation. And I'm not going to define it. I'm going to read you from the abstract of a paper published in 2006 in Nature. Now, Nature is just about the most prestigious journal there is. And here is... I'm reading. This is a quote. The logic underlying the coherent nature of quantum information processing often deviates from intuitive reasoning, leading to surprising effects. Counterfactual computation constitutes a striking example. The potential outcome of a quantum computation can be inferred even if the computer is not run. Here we demonstrate counterfactual computation implementing Grover's search algorithm with an all-optical approach. And this appeared in Nature. It was discussed seriously. I'm not going to comment further. Okay, that's all I'll say now. And as said, if you want to stay around, you want to ask more questions, I'll do that.